The next panel talks about content identification, measurement, and interoperability. You know, we've talked in the opening panel a little bit about content identification, but over the years, one of my partners in crime in terms of content identification, in terms of industry advocacy for content identification, has been Jane Clark. You know, Jane, I think, you know, when you first started with a project 5 years ago? 5 years ago, you started with a project called TAXI, the Trackable Cross-Platform Asset Identification Project, and looking about in measurement. So why is content identification important, and why did you make it such a central part of an agenda at CIM?
Hello, there we go. So CIM, for any of you who don't know, it's the Coalition for Innovative Media Measurement. We're a group of all the broadcast and cable networks, media buying agencies, advertisers, the end users of media measurement who are collaborating to innovate in solutions for cross-media measurement and bringing more granular measurement to television. So one of the key things that we realized as we started sort of laying out what do we need in terms of cross-media measurement was if you have an asset that's created, let's say it's a television show in linear television created by one of the networks, and now they're distributing it across all kinds of different platforms, there are so many different measurement systems, technology systems throughout the whole ecosystem that separately would key in the name of that asset all the different ways all along the chain, so the supply chain. So not only the asset itself, the content asset, but all of the ads, within it. And so the agency that created the ad had one name for it. The media company that, distributed it had another name for it. The media agency at the end who did the analysis, might have had another name for it. And these things were being rekeyed and entered so many different places along the system. So, and there's a lot of, inaccuracy, inefficiency, and a lack of speed in getting the results. So in the television industry, it takes 15 days to calculate the trading currency between buyers and sellers, which is based on a lot of legacy processes. And so the first thing we said was, could you find a standard asset identifier? Does one exist? And then we discovered Harold with Ad ID and ads, and Don Delchinos over here with content registry, entertainment ID registry. And so we started talking to them about how we could then get everybody, get adoption, work to support adoption, whatever way we can. And was there a way that we could then bind that identifier into the essence of the asset so that it wouldn't be stripped out and lost throughout the whole ecosystem? So, to make a long story short, this has been kind of a 5-year journey. We've been working with the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, who does these kinds of standards. They put out RFIs, RFPs. We evaluated a number of different vendors, and actually just last week have selected Kantar Media, a company from the UK. The technology that they have to kind of move to this next stage in the standardization and the ability to bind these identifiers into video assets.
And I want to go to Paul for a minute because, Paul, you've been, your career has sort of taken you in a variety of places where, you were, hold a lot of the intellectual property and some of the patents that talk about watermarking probably carry your name on them. Why watermarking? And, how does this announcement that Jane made last week about Kantar, how does it impact the industry in general?
Well, I think a major impact is on openness and competition, because that's one of the things that John, you talked about interoperability. Right now, almost all the watermarking systems that are out there are not interoperable. So unless you obtain a special license from the company who owns that technology, and they may or may not give that to you, then you don't have access to that technology at all. But throughout the years, at least from what I've seen, is the ability to have the data, the metadata that you're looking for, embedded directly into the asset, like in the audio or the video. That helps the problem of having other metadata that's like a sidecar. I think somebody mentioned sidecar yesterday or this morning. A sidecar, that metadata can get disjoint from the actual asset itself. So when you actually have something like IDR or AdID baked directly into the asset, it can't get disjoint unless you totally remove the audio. At that point, you've created a different asset.
Right.
So that's where I think this has the most relevance and importance.
Great. Scott, from a vendor perspective, when you've got open standards and open systems like this, what's the opportunity? What's the benefit? What's in it for you?
Good morning. So I'm Scott Maddox. I lead business development for TiVo's data business, and also previously had the pleasure of working with Paul at Nielsen. We launched a watermark-based platform to deliver synced programming for content owners. And I've been in and around the data space for a long time and have dealt with standards in various capacities. I'm super excited about watermark standards. For TiVo, that's an enabler, right? We have a lot of customers looking for content identification, content tracking solutions, and watermarks is a great way to do that. And if it's a standard, so much the better. I also want to touch on an earlier point made around unique IDs, because it's not just the watermark is a great sort of technology at its heart, but it's, I think one of the next key questions is, what's in the payload? What information is contained within that watermark? And a unique ID is going to be one of those things. This also touches on points made in John's keynote. You know, there's so-called the TMS ID calls itself an industry standard. TiVo and Rovi are all one now as TiVo. We talk about the Rovi ID as a standard. And those have been held proprietary up until this point. It's considered intellectual property. And I've been part of the internal debates in both of those companies. Well, should we open it up and make it more public? And I argue very strongly on the side that yes, we should open up the distribution and access to unique IDs, because we don't actually sell those. I mean, from a commercial perspective, we're not selling IDs. We're selling products and services around those IDs. And I think at the end, it benefits all the players in the industry and the ecosystem to open up standards around IDs. So we've been a strong supporter of IDR for that reason. And I think the consumer question comes back to me very often. Is this the best thing for the consumer? And I think now, more than ever, with the phenomenal fragmentation in the entertainment ecosystem, from creators to distributors to consumers to devices, we need these types of standards, both in terms of ID and watermarks, and I think those two go hand in hand. So I dig it.
Thank you. Don, standards in standards in program identification. Scott did a great job of articulating the nuance and the variety of everything that is called a standard in content identification. You know, IDR has terrific penetration, but how do we get IDR IDs and IDR metadata in the ecosystem, and what's the importance of a single ID?
Thanks for that good question. So Scott, first of all, thanks for the tip of the hat. Actually, you should know that TiVo does still have the ID proprietary in relation to IDR, and yet TiVo has the largest mapping in the world to IDR IDs. It's available, so that's a major progress, and that's why companies like TiVo get the idea that there's a standard here, a standard format for the ID, a way to get to that. But then, the business you're in is not about that; it's about leveraging that. And a lot of companies see that kind of value. So, one of the things about a lot of the conversation here has been about ads and how partners in crime. It's such an unpleasant word because you just say fellow travelers or friends, comrades in arms, maybe. Two kinds of IDs, right? The ad ID for ads and IDR for content play together, and certainly in the ad insertion world. When I got into this 6 years ago, it was from an advertising perspective. I was working with Chris and Canoe and a lot of the cable folks needing a better means of targeting the ads to the content. And so how do you find out about the content? You need kind of an identifier to find all that value-added data that TiVo and other companies have that's related to it to do better targeting. And so That's what EITR does. We operate a registry of now over a million records, film and television assets, with a unique ID. That's the standard part. But curating that registry is really what the business is, and making the APIs available to get those IDs, and then follow the trail to that value add metadata as well. So over a million IDs, and probably the most important part of that, from a, because you could use any ID really for this kind of matching. But what EITR has is a very complex hierarchy, and we have a slide on that actually. Yeah, there it is. So we have kind of three levels to an EITR record. And so at the title level, the highest level, it's a film or television program, the basic information about that program. One level down is then people start to create edits or versions of that ID. It could be a director's cut for a film. It could be the home entertainment or SVOD distribution of a television program. It gets its own ID, but then that's nested within the hierarchy, so it relates to that parent ID. And that gets you, and then there's a third level that's more about the technical encodings. You can actually add a different ID for the encoding. Again, all rolling up to that parent ID. And that gets an important word that Jane, you mentioned, which was granularity. So measurement's great for, you know, people want to know how did my, you know, film do across all theatrical, broadcast, home entertainment. But they also want to know how it did in each of those relative to the others. So measurement needs to be granular, and that's the piece I think that EITR maybe brings most value to.
And what's interesting, and Jane, you know, you touched on this in your opening, but granularity, you know, we've lived in a world of audience measurement where we're looking at large buckets. You know, the C3, the C7 currency is sort of where we are today. But advertisers are increasingly looking for granularity in terms of content ratings, commercial ratings. What's going to tip this industry to pay attention to that need for granularity? And what is tipping this industry in that way?
Well, I mean, basically, to take a page from Milana, she's still here. Everything in television is becoming digital, you know. So digital is very granular. You know, every ad, every piece of content, you can track it, attach information to it, evaluate it, follow it, analyze it. And so, you know, television has never, you know, been that way up until now. It was panel-based measurement, so you couldn't even, you know, I love to tell this story that when Cablevision and Time Warner Cable, the old Time Warner Cable, now Charter Spectrum, I guess it's called, combined their return path data for the New York market, because they both together kind of covered the whole market with all of their return path television data from their set-top boxes. When they put their data together, they discovered that over 30% of the viewing was to non-English language channels not measured by Nielsen. And then also, so the Cablevision, for instance, has 400 channels. Only like 140 or 160 maybe were measured by Nielsen. So the problem with the old measurement methods of using panels to estimate viewing, it completely falls apart in the, you know, it fell apart about 10 or 20 years ago for small niche cable channels, but it completely falls apart when you have cross-platform behaviors where you have, you know, someone in the same household watching some arcane piece of niche content and it's watching, starting it on one platform and finishing it on another platform. The necessity for granular measurement has been around for a while, and the technology is just enabling it as everything becomes more digital.
Scott,
There's another aspect to granularity, which I think is worth mentioning, and that's on the content side. And we talk about film and television and unique IDs and tracking these assets. And the worst half-hour TV show on earth will have a very long shelf life, for the most part. But think about what's happening in short form or the broader digital first space, and the granularity issue sort of comes into full relief. And by this, I mean folks like the multi-channel networks, the MCN. So full screen has 70,000 creators. They started out as YouTubers, now they're part of a video. These are the next gen video studios and networks. And there's a flood of content, some of it increasingly very good. Production values are coming up very, very quickly. But one of the things that we wrestle with at TiVo is we know how to manage data around film and television assets, books and games, but those are all, you know, relatively small numbers. When we start thinking about digital first, there's just an absolute explosion of content here, and we can't boil the ocean. We have to think about how to take the best of, and then also how to deal with a relatively short shelf life, right? The greatest episode of, you know, Rhett and Link's Good Mythical Morning, which is a fantastic series, has value 1 week and relatively very little value the following week. But these are the types of programming assets that are appealing to increasingly large millennial, Gen Z audiences making up half the population. We have to solve that, and there's another looming, you know, granularity issue, I think, that relates to the content itself.
Mm-hmm. So, Paul, we've spent the last year with engineers and very smart people in the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers going through the process of selecting a vendor. This is an unusual process for us as an industry. Can you talk a little bit about your experience, some learnings?
Yeah, I can. In fact, a lot of the people that were part of the standards group brought their independent learnings into the group in terms of what should be tested and how rigorous it should be tested. And I can tell you that the rigor that we went through on testing the technologies was the best I've ever seen. I mean, it's, you know, having worked in another company that has watermarking systems, I know their systems haven't gone through testing to that rigor. So it's incredible. So that, I think, is really the biggest thing, and that's something that, you know, George, this might be something for you to look at in the future if other watermarking things happen or come out, to look at some of the rigor that we went through those tests and maybe adopt them as part of your MRC accreditation.
Yeah, and again, you know, to that point, we spent a lot of time, you know, I've sort of heard the term the golden ears, you know, people who can listen to watermarks and know if they're imperceptible and understand that they don't interfere with each other and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right, because if you have pristine content that has not gone through any compression, that's the gold standard.
Right.
Once you take that content and run it through a compression system like Dolby AC3 or something else, that actually degrades the audio. And the systems that we test and the results that we got for many of the different types of content, because it is content dependent, but the different types of content, we found that the degradation of the content is less than what happens with audio compression, which that's important.
Don, you've got did you want to add something to that?
First of all, congratulations to Paul on the technical side and Jane for having the vision to kind of carry this through to get to this. That's a pretty major milestone.
I'm not completely there yet.
For people that, I take my milestones where I can get them, you know? I mean, that was a major one. I've been doing standards work for a long time, as you guys know, and it takes time and persistence and kind of the value vision that's what Jane brings to it, for certainly. So, and on a watermarking side, actually, EIDR has been embedded in watermarks for years now on the anti-piracy front. So we kind of know how to do that. It's you get a very small payload to work with, so you need a kind of machine-readable code that works for us there. There's also a separate standards group around ATSC 3.0, which has specified a different kind of watermark. We're arms dealers, so I don't care which watermark it is. I'll be there, but I do care that it gets adopted. So the carefulness of doing that in a way that people are going to adopt and get it into the broadcast stream is critical.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know, many of you in the room here are from media companies or possibly even affiliated with agencies or advertisers. To the extent that you can advocate for the adoption of the underlying ad ID and EIDR, you know, you can find a lot of ways there may be in the industry to pass these through, you know, in digital through VAST and some other standards. There's going to be new ways with new media to pass these through, but to the extent that we can get everybody to adopt the identifier, I think is the first critical step, because if we don't get all of the media companies, there's a little cost involved in kind of taking whatever media asset management system, sort of the method that you've used for identifying your assets for 60 years or whatever, and map it, as we've heard TiVo do here, to to the EIDR system and register every new asset with EIDR going forward. It takes a little work, maybe takes a little cost, takes a little thought, takes a little change in your process. But you know, it's huge if we can do that to bring you know, these huge interoperability kind of benefits to the industry. And the same with AdID. I mean, Harold's done some wonderful things to sort of get adoption of AdID. You know, partly the big step through the royalty payments, that was huge. But you know, throughout the whole ecosystem, there's still holdouts here and there. People have their own proprietary way of doing things, you know. And it holds back the benefit to everyone.
Right. And Don, you've got some international experience with audience measurement and some good use cases that you got some slides to go through as well.
Just one slide maybe that we could show is the, let's see, yeah, that one. But yeah, I mean, EIDR's and AdID, we've been part of different measurement solutions for years now. And so EIDR's been used in box office reporting, for example, for a while. VOD usage and the VOD kind of cable platform, Rentrak, now part of Comscore, has been doing that kind of measurement for a while. And then we had an interesting conversation with Sony Pictures, one of the founding members of EIDR, and they are a global distribution company, right? And all the Hollywood studios certainly have a major, global's now a major part of their business. So they were trying to track what's the performance of a Sony Picture in all these territories. And so they contracted with a company called EMS, Essential Media Services, to track, and I don't even know how many are up on this list, but those are all country-by-country measurement organizations. Some of them are private. Nielsen, Kantar, and others are sort of the measurement of record in those countries. Others are actually run by the government of the country, and there's sort of a way that gets done. And so accumulating and aggregating all of that measurement across, you know, hundreds of territories, literally, was a big problem. So they contracted EMS, and they assign EIDR IDs now. Either they're there when they come in, because some of those ratings agencies use EIDR already internationally, and the ones that don't, EMS hits the database and fills in the blanks for Sony and then reports back a whole roll-up international. That's a lot of manual labor that just got simplified into one kind of focused report, and that's so the reporting piece of this, along with the measurement, is critical. Then, when you've ingested all that, then you've got this sort of standard within the company to compare the data to measurement in other you know, not just theatrical, but your broadcast and home entertainment and cross-platform kind of destinations, and so. Our experience is there, and to Jane's point, it's not in every single workflow across these major studios and their constituent parts, and as they acquire more parts, they have to kind of integrate them into the title management system, but it's happening.
So in the last 2 minutes that we have, I want to open to the audience, and I want to ask the audience a question. You know, we've talked both in the opening panel, and we talked in this panel, and John talked about in his talk, standardization. What I, you know, what both Don and I hear as the content ID registries is from advertisers, from Don's case in his registrants, we aren't hearing, the advertisers and the content registrants aren't saying, we aren't hearing from the media that the idea of content identification is important. We're hearing that, don't worry, we've got you covered. We're going to solve your problems without you having to spend an extra few dollars to register content identifiers. And I guess that I'm going to open it up to any of the people who are media outlets in the audience. What can us as content ID registries do to help you to make it more important or make it a more higher agenda item to get content identifiers required and in the supply chain? So I'm going to open it up to anybody, any of the media. We've got some Viacom people here. We've got some NBC people here.
Hey, Harold, could I mention one thing about, one of the things about the watermark standard that we're working on with SMPTE is that there are different places where these watermarks can be inserted, and so there's different benefits to the media company that could accrue into just your workflows. So For instance, if an asset is created and at that point in time, whether it's an ad or a piece of content, it can be registered immediately, it can actually be watermarked at that point in time. So the identifier can be watermarked immediately into that piece of content. So aside from audience measurement, which is sort of what I care about, there's all kinds of uses just within workflows, within companies, that you now have a smart asset. You now have something that you know what it is as it's being passed throughout the food chain. And so I think that, you know, this has probably not been emphasized enough. You know, we've also added some other things as it gets broadcast by adding time codes and station codes so people get the proper credit for, you know, for the audiences. But that benefit of being able to just have a piece of content be smart, which is the name of this program, right?
All right. I thank my panel. And, you know, sorry, we had a question. Oh, one question over here.
Here we go. Hold on. Wait for the mic.
Yona Levinson from HBO. So I come from the book publishing industry, and I'm new to this, less than a year. And when I first came to this, I guess about a year ago, this conference, the thing that struck me was the similarities of the problems. But one of the big differences from an ID perspective is that in the book industry, ISBN is required. And the other thing that always that comes to my mind when I hear these kinds of panels is the good thing about standards is that there are so many of them.
And Yona, that's a great point. And I'm going to close on, I think we close on that. But, you know, it's like, yep. Oh, one more.
Yeah, I mean, it's been said before, but, you know, like with the UPC code, Walmart had the market power to demand it. It got adoption. You know, I think what we're seeing is a lot of large enterprise IT is not necessarily early movers on stuff. They wait and see with when the standards emerge. And the incentive, although some people see the benefit, but that we wait to see things shake out where the benefit is really palpable before we're going to move on something, and that's often because of cost and effort involved. And the idea that things can be totally automated, great, the idea will just happen sort of magically or through automation, you know, sometimes doesn't materialize, so I think that's part of the adoption issue.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, thank you. And I guess we'll continue this conversation at the break.
Absolutely. We'll be back. Thank you so much, panelists. Thank you, Harold. We'll be back here in about 20 minutes.